Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
And we're back on Chip Chat Live. I'm Allison Klein, and we're broadcasting live from the Intel Developer Forum event. It's day two of Chip Chat. And before we get to our next guests, I just wanted to give another reminder that we are giving away free books of Vintage Tomorrows. If you guys listened to the show yesterday, you heard from Intel futurist Brian Johnson talking about the steampunk movement and how steampunk has influenced Intel researchers' view of what technology needs to do tomorrow. If you'd like a free copy of his book on this topic, I saw the movie. Apparently, I'm the person that sees the movie and doesn't read the book, but I've heard the book is wonderful. Just tweet me at Tech Allison, and I will get you a copy as soon as I can, and we'll be giving them away until all of the copies are gone. But with that, I'd like to get to our next guests, two of my favorite folks to talk to, Ben Kepps and Riven Cohen. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. It's awesome to be here.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, Riv, this is different for us. Usually we sit on the same side of the table for an interview, but we host Digital Nibbles together, but you're on Chip Chat today. How does it feel?
It's good to be in the same room with you. I think it's going to be completely different.
And Ben, I was thinking about you this morning when I was thinking, gosh, at IDF, if we played the uncomfortable game of please stand up if you've traveled over so many miles to get here at IDF, you might have won the competition.
Yeah, I kind of generally win those competitions, but it's just a factor of my life.
So what have you guys experienced at the conference thus far? Ben, why don't we start with you?
So I was in the keynote this morning, and that was kind of exciting. There was lots of flashing lights. We all had wristbands, which were controlled from a tablet, which was kind of cool, and they flashed funny colors. That was all very exciting.
I felt like I was at a rave.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. It was almost like having a picture of a candle on your mobile phone and holding it up at a concert, kind of, but not quite. But I think exciting thing for me was yesterday, the whole AWS announcement. That was pretty exciting, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that. I know Reuven's pretty excited about that as well.
Yeah, Reuven, you've been blazing a new path on this topic on Twitter this morning.
I see your colleagues at Intel are very excited about this concept. And one of the things that I said this morning is it sort of marks these sort of next step in the evolution of computing a little bit. 10 years ago, you had this idea of, Intel inside, your traditional desktop computers. Now you, for the first time, are sort of branching out in this idea that the cloud is the computer in a lot of ways. I know that it's a kind of a topic that we've discussed many times, but this is kind of a pretty smart branding move, I think.
Well, and I think that it was driven based on the fact that customers are asking about hardware configurations for their services. They want to make sure that they've got the performance capabilities that they're expecting in terms of what system is running their service, and that's something that AWS has decided to do.
Don't forget, I'm very, very jealous. I want the Zen inside of the EC2 cloud as well, but I don't know that I can get that now that Intel's got their logo on there. That might be a block for me.
I think beyond the obvious marketing impact, and it is a real coup, there's some really interesting things there, because we've been hearing for years and years about commodity hardware, that it really doesn't matter. We're abstracting away any requirement for even caring about what stuff you run on. You get a virtual machine and that's it. And clearly, as the cloud moves into the enterprise, and obviously AWS is trying to move into the enterprise, people are realizing that actually that stuff is important. People do care. And no, they don't want to have to, rack and stack servers, and they don't want to have to think about configuration, but they want to know that their stuff is reliable and is going to work. And I think the fact that, it's really good timing. AWS is moving into the enterprise. They need some boxes ticked. The Intel Inside thing does that for them. For Intel, it's great because it's a huge boost to that whole credibility that, it still matters what's inside.
So we made some other announcements yesterday, too. We announced a new series of processors. That was our second series launched in 2 weeks. But I don't want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is a broader perspective on cloud. And so, Reuven, when you look at, there was a bunch of cloud conferences this week, and it seems like there's a bunch of cloud conferences every week. What is it that you think is at the top and zenith of people's mindsets right now in terms of cloud computing, and where are we going next?
You know, one of the underlying themes of the CloudBeat conference, which was put on by VentureBeat last couple days here in San Francisco, is this idea that the cloud is growing up. And the question becomes, what does that actually mean when the cloud grows up? We're probably, what, about 10 years in, maybe 8 years in to the concept. The idea for me of the evolution, the sort of growing up of the cloud is, as a business person, one of revenue. And the question then becomes, there's a lot of these initiatives, a lot of free open source initiatives that have popped up, a lot of hype around them, but it almost seems that some of the hype hasn't lived up to, you know, the reality of, you know, making money. And the question becomes one of sustainability. How do you sustain a business sector if there isn't actual money being made other than the venture capital being poured into it? And in any bubble, If it doesn't become real, it's going to burst, and all those companies are going to dissolve into nothing.
I think that's a really good point, and at the risk of being a little bit contentious on Chip Chat, you know, I was at a session at CloudBeat. I arranged the content along with Paul Miller for CloudBeat, and I was at a session where there were a few people on the stage, two of whom were Randy Bias from CloudScaling and Martin Mikos from Eucalyptus, and the two were up there, and it almost came to fisticuffs arguing about the minutiae of the AWS API and the compatibility.
And we're still going on that topic.
And we're still going on that topic. And at the end of the day, you know, I did a different session with Christian Riley from Bechtel, and you know, he was saying it doesn't matter. Enterprise has some pressing needs and some pressing concerns, but you know, as I said, the minutiae of API compatibility isn't one of them. What they've got some far bigger concerns, and I think, you know, the cloud is growing up, but the industry needs to grow up and stop wasting time talking about inconsequential details that don't actually make a difference to customers.
It seems like there's a lot of that going on lately. At least I've observed a lot of that going on lately, where we talk about technology for technology's sake rather than what is going to get to the end game for a customer value.
Well, I think to Reuven's point, I think it's because there has been a huge amount of money poured into the cloud industry generally. And I think there's a lot of pressure on people to get some revenue. People realize that there's a lot of undifferentiated vendors in the marketplace. And so the knives come out, and that's what we're seeing happening. And it's going to be really interesting. You know, I watch the space reasonably closely, and if you look at the OpenStack ecosystem, for example, there's a huge number of vendors there. And it's over the, you know, first few years of the project, it was very nice. They were all very friendly. I suspect that it's not going to be quite so friendly from here on in as people fight for revenue.
Yeah, it's co-opetition, but looking at that co-opetition, you know, I asked a few folks yesterday what they thought of, you know, A or B OpenStack company, preparing for my presentation with Chris Kemp from Nebula, and it was very, very personal attacks, not against the actual technology per se, but the people involved in the technology. You know, one person being overly biased, not saying who, the other person being overly animated or opinionated or this or that, and it was very eye-opening, you know, because my question wasn't specifically about any particular person. It was about the technology and whether one was better than the other. And my takeaway was there wasn't much difference between A or B or C OpenStack environment other than people sort of bad-mouthing each other.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's interesting here is that there's an amazing amount of market opportunity, obviously. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I would think about is, you know, if you guys were going to give some advice to these vendors, you know, what would you say to them in terms of having, you know, shifting focus and you know,
concentrate on the customer problem. You know, I've spent a bunch of time talking with Mario Müller from BMW, and you look at him and you know he's involved in a lot of different initiatives, ODCA obviously, but at the end of the day it's about finding solutions to problems that they have and enable them to provide their customers with higher value. And you know, vendors need to start thinking about that and not thinking about technical details. They need to think about ways that they can actually meet their customers' needs, because if they're not doing that, they're not going to be in business for long.
Well, it's an existential question, right? What's the purpose? What's the purpose of this cloud stuff we're doing? It's, you know, there's the same old, you know, questions and answers that we hear. Oh, it's a test dev. It's this and that. And that isn't an answer. That's not a purpose. You know, it's an I suppose maybe an application. But the broader question is where this technology takes us, you know, in the big picture of things. It's you know, and I don't think there's an easy answer to that. But well, it certainly needs to be asked.
And the difficulty with that is that if you're absolutely right, but when you start talking big picture, then people start saying things, well, there's this convergence of social and mobile and big data and we need to find ways to derive insights. And all that is absolutely true, and I can completely agree with it. But all that sounds like buzzword bingo. Mm-hmm. So how do you find there's this tension between looking at the big picture and looking for the sort of big underlying trends and tying that back to some kind of hard and fast deliverables? And that's, I think, the difficulty that a lot of cloud vendors have.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the bust of the dot-com boom in a way, in that there were, you know, how many companies that were out? You know, my friend was in PR at the time working for buildyourownpants.com. That's the one that I always think about. And, you know, lots of great ideas that never made a single dollar. But what we did see out of that is that existing businesses took the concepts of online and applied them to how they ran their businesses. And I'm wondering if you guys think the same thing. We're at risk of the cloud ecosystem suffering the same fate, where we see some of the, you know, traditional ISVs starting, you know, offering services. You know, how do we, you know, continue and foster startup innovation without risk of having that kind of, you know, cloud bust?
There's a fundamental challenge. This is especially true in the open source realm, where we've commoditized a lot of the integral pieces that we need, which is good. I think it's disruptive, but in doing so, we've forced ourselves into this position that says we need to monetize in other areas such as services, professional services, support, and things like that, which means that there's sort of this mentality that says we need to make our stuff complicated so we can justify the services that we want to offer at a premium. And the reality is, in a productization of these services, you don't want complexity. You don't want to have all these, you know, services that are required. So we're kind of working against, you know, these two competing factors.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a huge burst. I mean, never say never, but I don't think that'll happen. But there will be a lot of rationalization, and absolutely the large traditional companies are starting to offer these products and services, and you get to a point where existing startups all of a sudden have their lunch eaten by the legacy, in inverted commas, vendors.
So let's go back to IDF. We're in San Francisco. You know, I know that you guys have been out and about. You've attended some sessions. You've attended some parties. At least Ruv has attended parties. I don't know if you made it to more than one, Ben. Any other anecdotes that you want to share with the online audience about what you've seen from the broader community, not just Intel's announcements, but the broader community around technology innovation or things that you were surprised by?
I mean, people are excited. I mean, clearly, without wanting to go down the whole buzzword bingo route, you know, the whole mobile thing, the whole, you know, rise of slates, rise of new form factors, you know, we saw a bunch of stuff in the keynote this morning about, you know, two-in-ones, this merging of laptops and mobiles and slates all into sort of one form factor. That stuff's really exciting. I mean, I think, you know, to be honest, as is always the case when you're seeing the first generation of anything, of any innovation, it's a bit rough and ready, and the actual final result will be very different. But it's a really exciting time to be involved in this industry, because whether you're a hardware person or a software person or a business person, there's some exciting stuff happening, and that's really cool.
You know, the other thing I've seen is especially with the Apple announcement this week, mobile technology has lost its luster a little bit. You know, that was probably the least interesting Apple announcement I've heard in probably 6 years. A fingerprint reader? You know, that's the big news of the week for Apple. You know, something that's been available on a laptop for 10 years and in the Android ecosystem for probably at least a couple years. You know, the exciting story, I think, is not the mobile aspect any longer. It's the, you know, a bit of a cliche, but the Internet of Things. It's all those other things that now can be connected, whether it's, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think the big reveal, you know, one of the things that I do in keynotes is watch the audience reaction to things rather than just what's being said. Seemed like the big reveal yesterday was the announcement of Quark and, you know, new family of processors that addresses IoT. You know, we were talking about wearables earlier today on the program, and, you know, what do you guys think about wearables? And, you know, when is this going to become something that not just tech enthusiasts embrace?
Yeah, so clearly there's a lot of work to be done in the delivery of the opportunity around wearables. You know, the fact of the matter is that outside of, not even San Francisco, outside a very small part of the Bay Area, anyone wearing Google Glass looks kind of stupid. And actually inside that area, they look kind of stupid as well, but no one says so. You've got, you know, Samsung introduced its smartwatch that has, you know, the battery life of 8 or 10 hours or something. You know, that stuff just doesn't work, but those are all concepts for how the stuff could happen. And clearly, when we see some convergence of better form factors, you know, better battery life, more converged solutions, then it's all going to take off, and that's going to happen really fast because there's a lot of stealth work going on in that area. So within a couple of years, the whole idea of wearables will be the norm, I believe.
You know, it's not just wearables, it's embeddables. It's putting the computing processors, whatever you want to call it, the ability to collect and display information into everything. And it doesn't necessarily have to have that sort of smartphone sort of interface. And I think that what's exciting is there are a lot of different opportunities to integrate computing into our lives, and we haven't seen anything yet. I don't think that the smart watch is probably the optimal, or even the Google Glass is the optimal way to collect and display information.
I don't think people want to be known for wearing a wearable. I think that as invisible as that can get, you know, I'd like to see it embedded in your hat, Ruben, so that it can be collecting all sorts of information.
Yeah, well, I've said that many
times. It actually is.
Yeah, I've said that many times. I think the opportunities are for not making it obvious. It shouldn't necessarily be a status symbol.
Exactly.
I think, so there's a couple of things there. One is that the technology needs to mature so that it can be invisible. But I think as well as that, the vendors are very, very sensitive to public concern about, you know, privacy and other issues. And so they are taking a measured approach towards how this stuff develops, because they need to not overstretch the public tolerance for pervasive computing.
Now, and that's, you know, a great topic, which is, are our perceptions, and I know we've talked about this on Digital Nibbles before, Ruth, but are our perceptions about privacy changing, or are we just becoming aware that we actually have risks to privacy with our data online?
I think people were getting a lot more comfortable with things until Ed Snowden and his posse did what they did. I think that's probably a good thing, because people need to be more aware and more realistic. Personally, I don't think it's a huge issue. I mean, I know every time I say that I have friends who lean to the left, and they tend to make comments about, well, it's fine as long as you've got a benign government or what have you. Maybe I'm naive, but I kind of think that once it becomes pervasive, it's big enough that no one's going to do anything stupid.
Well, you know, the challenge that we have is, you know, if we weren't doing it, you know, the question would be, why not, right? Because it's there, it's accessible. I don't think it should be abused. I think there should be oversight in terms of our privacy, especially how it's, you know, accessed from, you know, the government, which is intended, at least in this country, to be for the people. But I think I agree with Ben. I think that you need a certain level of involvement to protect us from the bad guys who are not going to be afraid to do exactly the same things and use it for the powers of evil.
What's interesting, I think, is that, you know, we're concerned about governments having information about us, but for some reason we're not as concerned about corporations having information about us.
That's the bizarre thing. I mean, when Prism came out, you know, I was saying, look, you've been giving all of your data to Google for the past 10 years, and yet you're relaxed about that, but you're not relaxed about the government having your data. That's
Well, it's worse than that. So this morning, Google was kind of slapped on the wrist for the work that they were doing with their Street View collectors, where they were actually sending their cars around, and they were scanning Wi-Fi networks, and not just scanning the Wi-Fi networks. That's not the problem, I don't think. So they found unsecured Wi-Fi networks. Then they automatically connected to them, looked at all the files in your network, and collected that data. And that's awful. It should be terrifying. And all they got was a little fine, you know? That's the travesty right now.
You know, and I think that is, to me, that is the next wave. Because, you know, if we look at a world where our data can be actually driving decisions for us, you know, there's an example I saw where, you know, my data knows that I like a certain band. And so, it decides to buy a ticket for me for a concert, engages in a transaction, knowing that it can sell the ticket back if I decide not to want it. And it just offers it up to me. You know, I can see the value in this. I'm a busy person. But at the same time, am I trusting this corporation that I'm doing a transaction with, my data is doing a transaction with me, more than anybody else? I don't know.
Yeah, and I guess the bottom line comes down to what value does that, you know, does that drive for you? So if we're talking about, you know, government oversight of our data, is my individual security, you know, debatable individual security, is that worth more than my privacy? And in the commercial case, is you being able to get a ticket which you probably couldn't get otherwise, is it worth giving up something for that? And I think history has shown over the past 10 or 20 years that we are prepared to give up some privacy in return for a better whatever it is we're getting. I think we need to make a conscious decision, and I think that's the difference, that as consumers en masse, we haven't been aware of that transaction that is occurring. We haven't been aware what we've been giving up for that better service. And I think transparency and education is really important.
You know, the other, just on a slightly different topic, the other day I was asked a question. What would I do if the internet and technology suddenly stopped working or it didn't exist at all? You know, and it's a fundamental question, right? And
I think you might spontaneously combust.
You know, but it actually occurred to me that, the value proposition, remove Twitter, remove the internet, is one of relationships, right? It's at the fundamental core of what I do. So back to the topic of you know, where technology leads us, you know, it should augment what we're natively good at, whether that, for me, that means being a connector, you know, being able to build relationships with people, what have you. Then the question then becomes, the technology itself, it becomes the primary point rather than the secondary, thing that helps us as human beings. I don't know. It's again, one of those bigger picture type of questions.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit different. I mean, I live a kind of a bizarre life in that I live on a little farm in New Zealand, and when I'm not sitting in front of my computer, I go outside and make things out of wood and have animals and have my orchard and stuff. So I think we need to be really aware that if we look at the global population as a whole, this whole tech involvement is only a small part of what we do. And you know, as a citizenry, we wouldn't all self-combust if our precious little iOS devices just went away into the ether.
So, Reuven, I think that the real answer here is that both of us need to go buy some sheep, and we'll be fine with
that. But real sheep, not virtual sheep, please.
Exactly. Exactly. We're not going to play whatever that farm game is on Facebook. So finally, what's next for both of you guys? I know, Riv, you have a new career that we should probably mention, and you want to talk a little bit about that. And Ben, what is the latest in terms of your consulting work, and where can we find you next?
Sure. So I've got a big couple of weeks. I've got another few events here in the Bay Area, and then I head to London for Structure, another conference next week. But doing a lot of work with companies around kind of envisaging the future and how they're going to react and what that means in terms of technology, but also in terms of people and culture. So just lots more work in that sort of area.
Nice. I will be in Structure in London as well, hanging out with Mario Mueller from BMW and the other ODCA guys. So
you should see if we could drive one of the new i8s.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see if we can. But it would have the wheel on the wrong side. I'm not sure if I
can
could
cope
do that.
With that.
Okay. You could be the driver. Rube, what's newest with you?
Well, I like the sounds of that BMW, but I've kind of gone to the other side, I suppose, in a corporate life, and it kind of, for me, as someone who's always been sort of self-employed, an entrepreneur, it's actually quite interesting to see the inner workings of a company that have close to 10,000 employees. So I'm trying to figure out how to navigate that whole thing. I've got, I think, in some ways, the best job at Citrix. I get to do exactly what I'm doing here today, meet interesting people, talk to interesting people, and help, again, as I said, connect the dots a little bit. I'm, a kind of connector of sorts.
I've heard that you've been attending a lot of meetings.
Yeah, they love to meet about stuff. And you know, I don't know if all those meetings are all that necessary, but I guess that's what corporate life is all about. But
Well, welcome to the corporate world where conference rooms are king. Thank you so much for being on the program, guys. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Ruve and I are on Digital Nibbles every other week. Ben is a frequent guest of that program as well. And have a great time with the rest of IDF.
Thanks, Alice.
Awesome. Thank you.